Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 31st of May. Our main stories: Donald Trump lashes out at Robert Mueller after the former special counsel says he didn't exonerate the president of obstructing justice. Saudi Arabia holds emergency talks about Iran and even invites its rival Qatar. And more than 20 people are still missing after a riverboat sank in Budapest. 7 bodies have been recovered. Also in this podcast:
they told my husband that he had about an hour with her and that she was going to pass away. But that hour turned into 2 hours, which turned into a day, which turned into a week.
The smallest ever premature baby is released from hospital. Ever since the special counsel and former FBI director Robert Mueller handed over his report into Russian election interference, Donald Trump has been keen to point out that the inquiry found no collusion with his campaign team. Indeed, twice in the past couple of days, he's tweeted, "Case closed." But that hasn't stopped the president launching into an angry rant about Mr. Mueller, who he claimed had been biased because he wanted to get his old job back.
He was conflicted. Look, Robert Mueller should have never been chosen, because he wanted the FBI job and he didn't get it. And the next day, he was picked as special counsel. So you tell somebody, "I'm sorry, you can't have the job." And then after you say that, he's going to make a ruling on you. It doesn't work that way.
Mr. Trump also said he'd had a business dispute with Mr. Mueller. The comments came just before the president boarded a helicopter at the White House, and a day after Mr. Mueller finally broke his silence over the investigation, pointing out he hadn't exonerated the president of obstruction of justice. I heard more about Mr. Trump's fiery comments from our correspondent in Washington, Tara McKelvey.
President Trump's style is often very personal, and he goes after people in a very personal way, just as he did with Mr. Mueller. But it's true, it's gotten really ramped up now. And part of it is that President Trump's been able to rely on his conservative base and this fight that they have against Washington. And they've certainly lined up behind him and his fight against the Russia investigation. But lately, President Trump seems a little bit worried about Mr. Mueller and his standing. There was a Fox News poll that showed conservatives trusted Mr. Mueller more than they trusted Mr. Trump in terms of the Russia investigation. So this is a kind of sign that would be troubling for Mr. Trump and could help explain why he's doubling down on Mr. Mueller.
And there's some suggestion that Mr. Mueller's comments yesterday sort of paved the way more likely to impeachment. How does that work?
Mr. Mueller was very clear in his statement about what the province of the special counsel office was, and he was sending a clear signal to other branches of government. If they're interested in pursuing this, they have options to do that. One of them is impeachment. U.S. members of U.S. Congress can go ahead with impeachment proceedings against the president. And that is now a big debate within the Democratic Party, and it has shifted. It used to be just something that people on the left of the Democratic Party talked about, but now it's becoming more and more an important subject for all different members across the spectrum in the Democratic Party.
At the same time, looking at the overall issue, Donald Trump has tweeted, "I have nothing to do with Russia helping get me elected," thus implying Russia did have a role in his victory. Was that just a slip of the tongue or keyboard?
Yeah, you kind of wonder. It could be maybe he was writing it too fast, or maybe it was a Freudian slip. Hard to know. Traditionally, President Trump has been very clear that it was he who got himself elected. I talked to him about the issue on Air Force One, and I remember him saying that it was the American people that elected him, and the Russians weren't, you know, they weren't the reason that he got elected. But then you saw it later, he was explaining to the reporters the same thing. It's very important to President Trump to make it clear to people that he was elected and he beat his rival, Hillary Clinton, and it wasn't the Russians that did it.
Tara McKelvey in Washington. The King of Saudi Arabia has called on Gulf states to do everything necessary to stop Iran interfering in other countries' affairs. Speaking at an emergency summit in Mecca, the King accused Iran of carrying out criminal acts, a reference to recent attacks on oil tankers and a pipeline, which the Iranians say they had nothing to do with. The Saudis even invited Qatar to attend the talks, even though the two nations have been embroiled in a deep dispute for the past 2 years. Ahead of the meetings, the Saudi Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Adel Al-Jubeir, spoke to the BBC.
We have made it very clear that we don't want war. We have made it very clear that we don't want escalation. But we have also made it very clear that we cannot tolerate continued Iranian aggression against us and our allies in the region. The world has made that position known. A large number of countries have condemned Iran's actions. Iran is subject to sanctions because of its actions.
I asked our correspondent Lise Doucette in Saudi Arabia what we could expect to come out of the various summits in Mecca.
Well, what the Saudis would like to come out of them is a very strong, a very united statement, a show of solidarity and strength across the Arab and the Muslim world when it comes to Iran's policies and, as the kingdom sees it, Iran's hostile aggression in the region. But I think talking to other Arab foreign ministers who were here in Jeddah yesterday, that is almost impossible to achieve. Take, for example, the Turkish president isn't here because he doesn't want to sign up to something which will be anti-Iranian. He works very closely with Iran on some issues. The Lebanese foreign minister is not here because he's close to Hezbollah, which, of course, is linked to Iran. So there are countries like Iraq and Lebanon who have very long-standing close relationships with Iran, who cannot be part of any effort to denounce Iran. So they're going to have to try to find a way forward. Everyone knows there has to be a solution to this problem. Some of them want to tackle Iran militarily. Some of them just want deterrence. And others say, well, let's talk about it, that Iran is part of the region.
And the reason that they are particularly worried at this moment is because of those recent attacks on oil infrastructure.
Yes, these summits are being described as emergency summits to convey a sense of crisis. So what is the emergency? Yes, there has been a spike in tension in the Strait of Hormuz, the vital shipping lanes of the world. More than a third of the world's oil supplies travel through there. There were the what was called sabotage of four vessels, including two Saudi oil tankers. There was drone strikes against the kingdom, but it was the Houthi rebels of Yemen who claimed responsibility for them. But as far as Saudi Arabia is concerned, the Houthis are linked to Iran, and so therefore they blamed Iran. So Iran is denying that it was behind any of these attacks. But what happens at this moment, where tensions are running high, there's an escalating war of words, it increases the risk of miscalculation, an accidental confrontation of either vessels in the Persian Gulf or forces in Iraq. And I think that's what puts people on edge, is that it just ratchets up the tension a little bit more and creates the risk of a tumbling toward the conflict that everybody says they want to avoid.
And what is the significance of the visit by the Qatari Prime Minister? Might this be the first step towards ending those tensions?
If it is a step, it is a very small step. It would have been very difficult for King Salman not to invite the Qatari emir. It's very clear it's a summit of Gulf leaders. It's a summit of the Arab League. It's a meeting of the Islamic Conference Organization. There's even said to be a junior Iranian official here for the Islamic Conference Organization. If the emir of Qatar had come, that would have said something, because that is what the king wants. This is supposed to be a summit of rulers. The prime minister has come. He's the most senior official. So it is significant. But I was trying to ascertain last night from some of the organizers, well, what does this mean? Is it a breakthrough? They said, well, maybe not a breakthrough, maybe a step forward. But on both sides, both on Qatar's side and on the Saudi Arabia and its allies who impose this diplomatic and economic political blockade, the issues, the hostilities are so deep that they won't be resolved by simply Qatari's prime minister coming here. But at least it sends the message that perhaps they can start talking.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, in Saudi Arabia. Hungarian police have detained the captain of a cruise ship that collided with a smaller sightseeing boat on the River Danube in Budapest on Wednesday night. Seven bodies have been recovered after the incident, but more than 20 people are still missing. Our correspondent, Nick Thorpe, has the latest.
What's happened is that after a day of investigations by the Hungarian police, they were collecting video recordings, CCTV and tourists and other recordings made by people along the shore of the Danube. They also interviewed the captain of the large cruise liner. He's a Ukrainian citizen. He was interviewed during the night soon after the accident happened. And we now know from a statement from the Hungarian police, he has been arrested on suspicion of causing the accident. According to the official sheet here, it says reckless misconduct in waterborne traffic in an incident which caused mass casualties.
And you say mass casualties, more than 20 people still missing. Is there any hope for them?
I'm afraid to say probably not. No, we know that seven people died, seven bodies were taken from the river soon after the accident. Seven people actually survived of the total of 35 that were on board, and they were all rescued effectively within the first 20 or 25 minutes, taken from the very cold waters of the Danube by small passing ships in the river. So the 21 missing, presumably until their bodies are actually found, they won't be declared dead. But it looks as though that the total death toll for this tragedy will rise to probably to 28.
Our correspondent in the Hungarian capital, Budapest, Nick Thorpe, talking to my colleague Alex Ritson. Burnout is a phrase that has become increasingly common in the modern world of work to describe feelings of being physically and emotionally run down. Now, the World Health Organization has reclassified it as a chronic workplace stress that hasn't been successfully managed. But what does that mean in practice? Siobhan Murray is a resilience coach and psychotherapist and author of The Burnout Solution.
Burnout is not just in the workplace. It is something that's right across the board, that if we can now see things that are being going to be implemented, strategies that are being implemented as policy within companies to support people who have a tendency or experiencing burnout, rather than it being companies that feel that they are ticking the boxes, maybe saying they're doing one thing and not providing it, or that you have some companies who are phenomenal, who are really, really embracing the fact, the way that people are working and cutting back. One company in particular that I do work with, they have a 7 p.m. to a 7 a.m. tech embargo. They don't allow their staff to go online to check emails. That's what we need to start seeing more of to help support those who are experiencing burnout. The way I describe burnout is mental, physical, and physical exhaustion that's brought on for prolonged periods of emotionally demanding situations of a period of around 3 months. So we will always have busy periods in life. There's always going to be these pockets of busyness. But when that becomes continual and the emotionally demanding experience of that with no recognition starts to override having down periods where we're not being pulled in all directions, that's when we start to see people experiencing burnout. Stress is really important and we need it. Anxiety is really important and we need it. But our bodies are not built to be in perpetual stress from the minute our eyes open to the minute our eyes get closed. And that the effects that's having physically on our bodies, as well as emotionally, because it's twofold. It's not just the emotional impact. It is the physical impact, that exhaustion. Even if you've had a night's sleep and you wake up and by 10 a.m., you're back to feeling like it's 10 p.m. at night. That constant day-in, day-out exhaustion.
Siobhan Murray. Zimbabwe is facing the prospect of more power cuts as the water levels at its main hydroelectric dam on Lake Kariba continue to fall because of drought. Our correspondent in Harare, Shingai Nyoka, told me more.
Well, the major problem, as you've alluded to, is the fact that Zimbabwe is facing one of its worst droughts in recorded history. But there's also another problem, which is the foreign currency shortages. And this has contributed to the intensity of these blackouts. Zimbabwe last had power cuts about 3 years ago, and it would import power from Mozambique or South Africa to cover the shortfall. But now it's in arrears of about $80 million to South Africa's Eskom. And only when it pays this will it be able to import power from South Africa. It won't totally end the blackouts, but it will help to improve the situation.
So what is life like at the moment for people in Zimbabwe?
Well, as you can imagine, it's incredibly difficult. 10 hours without electricity every day. And in some places, it goes out at 5 in the morning and comes back mid-afternoon. In other places, mid-afternoon to 10 o'clock at night. And these are critical peak hours of activity for most people. So it's affected how often we're able to cook hot meals for our families. And many people instead have started resorting to firewood in their back gardens to cook. It affects access to hot water and hot baths as winter sets in and how children do their homework. And in the past, most people would, or many people would be able to buy generators or use generators. But currently, there's also a shortage of fuel. And the price of that fuel has gone up threefold since January. And businesses are also affected that they have to use generators instead of electricity. And that's also pushed up the cost of doing business and the cost of their prices. So it really has been a very frustrating time for Zimbabweans.
The government, I imagine, can do very little about the lack of rain. Can it do anything about the lack of foreign currency?
Well, it's a long-term problem, and one of the forecasts that we have is that even if there is a good rainy season, Zimbabwe still has many years ahead of it, experiencing power cuts, maybe not of this magnitude. But the government has also been accused of poor long-term planning to increase power capacity. There's been allegations of corruption in terms of projects and tenders to develop alternative sources of power. But the electricity company also has huge debts. It's owed about $200 million in arrears, and not just by individuals, but by government ministers and companies. And so they will also need to improve this debt collection if they are to begin to import some of the electricity that's needed, and also build capacity in terms of the power supply.
Chingai Nyoka in Harare. And still to come on the podcast, how the growing economic crisis in Venezuela is making life even more difficult for the poor in Cuba. People lose their sense of smell for many reasons: malnutrition, schizophrenia, or even an underactive thyroid. Until now, the loss was almost always irreversible, but a new study suggests that stem cell therapy can repair loss of smell without surgery using nose drops. One of the researchers is Bradley Goldstein from the University of Miami.
There's quite a bit of evidence that many of these more common forms of olfactory loss can be due to damage in the periphery, sort of out in the nose, in the what's called the olfactory epithelium. And that sort of damage can result in a loss of the olfactory neurons, which are the key cells that need to detect odors. So we were interested in seeing if a way to replace those cells using a cell-based therapy might be feasible. So we used a mouse model. It's important to stress that this is, you know, sort of a preclinical or animal research. So we used a mouse model where we could make the mice have a reduced or absent sense of smell. And we tested putting in a cell suspension, sort of as a nasal droplets containing, we had them sniff in these droplets containing an adult tissue-specific stem cell to see if that would engraft, and if so, would these cells then give rise to new olfactory cells that could do something useful and help repair that damage.
When do you think you may start trying this in humans then? Clearly there is a leap to be made. When do you think that can begin?
Yeah, I want to be very clear. There's certainly a lot to be done before we go ahead and adapt this to humans. But I think it certainly shows that it does warrant further study. Modeling things in mice is obviously different than exactly what we might encounter clinically in humans. There's a lot we still just don't understand about the mechanisms of smell loss in humans.
I realize that you're a scientist rather than a sommelier or a restaurant critic, but just to underline here, I guess some people listening to this might think, well, you know, losing a sense of smell, it's not so important, it's not as key as losing one's hearing or one's sight, but it can be enormously distressing and limiting, can't it?
Well, that's right, and we maybe tend to overlook it a little bit until it's not working. But as a clinician and a scientist, so, you know, I do see patients with smell loss, and they sometimes describe in you know, very nice detail sort of how it affects them. You know, I recall one patient I met who had grown up in the Caribbean on an island, and she hadn't been home in quite a while, and she suffered from a post-viral olfactory loss, I believe, and she had gone home to visit, and she said, you know, it just didn't even feel like home. I'm there, but I'm not there. You know, all of those scents, the spices, the smell of the beach, the smell of my parents' home, they're missing. And she just felt like she wasn't really home and became really quite depressed by that.
Bradley Goldstein talking to Tim Franks. A group of Algerians living abroad has set up an international task force to try to track down public funds they say were embezzled by the former president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, and his allies. Our correspondent Louise de West has the story.
Lachimi Bolassine is an Algerian lawyer living in Switzerland. He says he is part of a group of 25 people in various countries, doctors, lawyers, engineers, economists, artists, who are asking governments in Europe and America to freeze assets they believe were illegally taken from the Algerian people. I asked Mr. Bolassine how much money he believed was at stake.
It varies between $24 billion and $60 billion, according to different estimates. But for me as a lawyer, even if it's just $1,000 that was stolen from a victim, in this case the Algerian people, even $1,000 needs to be restituted. For me, the number doesn't matter much. For me, those who are victims. Justice must prevail and the people's rights must be respected.
Tracking down the funds is one step that is already very challenging in itself. The other step is the restitution of these funds, and previous examples have shown how complex and rarely successful this is. Following the Arab Spring, the EU froze the assets of President Ben Ali of Tunisia and President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, as well as those of their family and associates. But last month, the European Council on Foreign Relations said little progress had been made in terms of restoring those assets to the states from which they were stolen. Bolassine thinks it can be different for Algeria.
Le cas de l'Algérie n'a absolument rien à voir avec l'Égypte.
The case of Algeria has nothing to do with the case of Egypt. If there is the political will to pursue this in Switzerland and in Algeria, then the procedure will go much farther and be much quicker. And we are not limiting ourselves to Switzerland. We are also appealing other countries. For example, in the United Kingdom, we are going to ask for assets to be frozen. We have names and concrete evidence.
Bouteflika and his allies have not yet responded to the accusations or to the creation of this task force, but their 20 years in power have been tarnished by numerous corruption allegations. Since the new government was installed in April, some investigations have been initiated. Just this week, the Supreme Court has announced that they are investigating 12 officials, including two former prime ministers, over corruption allegations.
Louise de West. The economic outlook for communist-run Cuba is bleak. The authorities have announced rationing of basic products, including chicken and soap. And in recent weeks, people have been queuing for hours at supermarkets. With its longtime socialist ally Venezuela also suffering, support for the communist island has been cut and imports have fallen, leading to growing shortages. And many Cubans fear it's going to get much worse. Will Grant reports from Havana.
Cuba's annual May Day parade is a display of the island's revolutionary might, a chance for the communist leadership to revel in the workers' unwavering support. At least, that's the notion. This year, though, it came amid deep uncertainty. Former president and Communist Party leader Raúl Castro recently warned Cubans to brace themselves, likening the country's economic forecast to the worst years of austerity in the 1990s, known as the Special Period. One high-ranking official at the event, 91-year-old Guillermo García Frías, struck on a novel solution to Cuba's impending problems with food security. On state TV, he said the government department he runs had begun rearing ostriches and large rodents called jutias for their meat. Needless to say, it was greeted with derision, both on the streets and online. Beyond the ostrich jokes, though, the first signs of a new economic crisis are beginning to show. In Cuba's supermarkets, an altogether less exotic species of bird, chicken, has prompted some desperate scenes and even fistfights.
I am walking down a queue for chicken in the supermarket. I'm having to record this on my mobile phone because the authorities don't want people in any way recording it. But in this one supermarket, the queue is incredibly long. It's already going to take people 3 or 4 hours to get to the front to pick up their maximum of 2 bags of chicken per person.
The reason for the tough times is twofold. First, the collapse of oil-rich socialist ally Venezuela. The political chaos and economic crisis under President Maduro have meant a precipitous drop in Venezuela's oil exports to Cuba. The other main reason, of course, is the Trump administration.
The Cuban regime has spread its ideological influence into Venezuela and throughout Maduro's regime.
At an event in Miami in April, on the anniversary of the failed invasion of the Bay of Pigs, the U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton announced new sanctions on Cuba over its support for Venezuela. Specifically, the Trump administration
has decided to end the Helms-Burton Title III waivers once and for all.
That means that Americans can now sue international companies over property expropriated by the Cuban Revolution.
Security Advisor Bolton is a pathological liar.
Havana was quick to issue a furious response. The Cuban Foreign Minister, Bruno Rodriguez, denied the Trump administration's accusation that Cuba has deployed tens of thousands of troops to Venezuela, saying the Cuban personnel in the South American nation were doctors and nurses. A couple of weeks later, Cuba opened its annual tourism fair. For an island potentially on the brink of some serious economic woes, the fair has taken on new importance, and the Cuban government is largely banking on tourism to lift the country's prospects. The coming months may prove especially challenging in Cuba. Mr. Bolton has described the three socialist allies, Venezuela, Cuba and Nicaragua, as the troika of tyranny, and Washington clearly intends to make life as difficult as possible for Havana unless it pulls support for President Maduro. Even then, the Trump administration wouldn't let up until the communist-run government is gone too. Yet in 6 decades, economic sanctions haven't forced a change of power in Cuba and aren't likely to now. The island's leadership is surely worried that a new generation of Cubans might react angrily if things get as ugly as they did in the 1990s. But for now, they're just hoping tourist dollars and a few friendly nations can help stop the gap left by Venezuela's collapse.
That report from Havana by Will Grant. Sergei Polunin is a controversial ballet dancer who has a tattoo of Vladimir Putin on his chest. He got into trouble earlier this year when he posted comments widely considered to be homophobic and sexist, charges he denied. Sergei Polunin is currently in London for a series of performances. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd went to meet him.
One of the pieces Sergei Polunin is dancing to this week in London is Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, as turbulent as his own career. In January, he alienated lots of fans with comments on Instagram, which some took as anti-gay. Polunin says he was talking only about the importance in dance of masculinity.
And I stand by my words, male energy and male dancers. It's important to have that on stage, and that's what audience love. They like individuality, the strength. It doesn't matter if you're gay or straight. It definitely wasn't anti-gay. I don't know if I'm addicted to controversy, but it does follow me somehow, and it repeats time after time.
Born in Ukraine, he quit Britain's Royal Ballet at 22, just as people were saying he was the male dancer of his generation. The shows in London are his own creation. Early reviews have not been kind. But unlike most ballet stars, his fan base isn't only theatrical. My lover's got humour. His dance video to the song Take Me to Church by the Irish musician Hozier has been viewed 27 million times on YouTube. It's probably what fans expect of Sergei Polunin, intense, sexy and a little troubled. Take me to church, I was like a dog at the shrine of it was, he says, just how he felt the day they shot it in Hawaii. It's the same in London. What happens on stage each time is a mystery.
I don't know if it's going to be my best show, first show, or I'm going to have a quiet performance or very emotional. I know I'm going to step on stage and I will trust sort of the universe that it's going to be right. I'm 100% there.
Report by Vincent Dowd. Now, when she was born 16 weeks early, she was so tiny she was given just hours to live. But 5 months later, the world's smallest surviving premature baby has been discharged from hospital in the United States. Our correspondent Richard Hamilton has the details.
The baby girl called Sabie was born just 23 weeks into her mother's pregnancy at Sharp Mary Birch Hospital for Women and Newborns in San Diego, California. Doctors said she was delivered via an emergency cesarean section in December after severe pregnancy complications had put her mother's life at risk. Baby Sabie weighed just 245 grams, or 8.6 ounces. That's the same weight as a large apple. One of the nurses said Sabie was so tiny at birth that you could barely see her on the bed. In a video released by the hospital, her mother said it was a miracle that she survived.
I just felt very uncomfortable, and I thought maybe this is part of the pregnancy. They told me that I had preeclampsia. My blood pressure was very, very high, over 200, and they had to deliver her really quick. And I kept telling them, but she's not going to survive. I'm only 23 weeks. They told my husband that he had about an hour with her and that she was going to pass away. But that hour turned into 2 hours, which turned into a day, which turned into a week.
As she had struggled for her life, the sign posted by her crib read, "Tiny but mighty."
I mean, I feel blessed. I mean, she is the smallest baby, but she's mine.
Paul Wozniak is the doctor who delivered Sabie at the hospital.
I and the whole team were amazed. She was much smaller than we anticipated. And we all sort of just looked at each other. You know, I listened to her lungs and her heart rate was great. So we said, well, we'll try to put a tube in to help her breathe. But honestly, I didn't think it was going to be able to go in. But fortunately, it did. She had the usual up and downs of a very premature baby, but in the delivery room, we were just amazed and worried that we weren't going to be able to do anything.
Baby Sabie was released from hospital after nearly 5 months in the neonatal intensive care unit. She came home weighing a healthy 2.5 kilograms or 5.5 pounds and wearing a graduation cap.
Richard Hamilton reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to send us any comments, the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.